All right. So I think I'll start out, 'cause probably no one here, I don't see the big NMR group. So I think probably no one here really knows what nuclear, oh, you okay. Somebody knows what nuclear magnetic resonance is, but most people don't. So I think most of the talk, really, I think I'll explain it a little bit about nuclear magnetic resonance. So nuclear magnetic resonance is this fundamentally quantum mechanical phenomenon, but I'm not going to say anything about quantum mechanics, because it's this fundamentally quantum mechanical phenomenon that turns out to have a perfectly beautiful and adequate classical description. So it begins with the following picture. So you draw an arrow up, and you label that arrow B0. And that's the background magnetic field. And typically, this is an enormous magnetic field. Like, in a clinical MR machine, it's at least 1.5 Tesla. So that's 30,000 times the background field. So it's an enormous field. And then you have, in that field, a dipole. So mu, this is a magnetic dipole. Now, a magnetic dipole, well, for example, if we just had a little coil of superconducting wire with current flowing through it, it would produce a little dipole like that. Now, what happens when you have a magnetic field and you have a dipole? The field exerts a torque on the dipole, and the torque is just mu cross B0. And, of course, the signs might all be wrong, but what can you do? What does the torque do? Well, the torque will change the angular momentum. So we have this classical equation that dj dt is mu cross B0. So this is just what would happen if I had a little loop of wire and I set it into this field somehow or the other. And what would happen is it would satisfy this equation, and what would happen is that the thing would start to precess and would go around on a little cone. The length of the vector would be unchanged, and it would just precess around. This angle would be unchanged, and it would just precess around that axis. Okay, so it turns out that a proton has a spin, and it also has an angular momentum. And what makes nuclear magnetic resonance work, in effect, is that the angular momentum and the spin are related by a simple equation. So this is the, I'll call it proton here, proton there. That's the intrinsic spin. So this is a quantum mechanical thing, and this is the intrinsic angular momentum. They're connected by this simple relation. And in light of that relation, I can just plug this expression in to this equation. And there, it does require some argument to explain why this formal manipulation, which I'm doing here with this spin, which is really a quantum mechanical object, not a classical mechanical object, and one has to discuss how does the spin interact with the magnetic field. I'm going to omit all of that discussion. You get the following equation, that d mu dt is gamma times mu cross B0. So that's a classical equation that will describe what happens to the proton. Well, really not the spin, but the magnetization that is induced by the spin when it sits in a magnetic field. And it's just the picture we drew there. We have the big field. We had the little proton spin, and it would just precess. All right, now it will precess at a characteristic frequency. This number here, I should say gamma, this is what's called the gyromagnetic ratio. And the number actually is, gamma is for a naked proton, 2 pi times 42.58 megahertz per Tesla. So that means that in a 1 Tesla field, the proton will precess at 42.58 megahertz. Now, that's a fortuitous thing. because 42.58 megahertz is just an ordinary radio frequency. So it's a frequency that is easily detected on the one hand, and it's a frequency that will not harm you on the other hand. So it's a fortuitous thing that the number turned out to be that. That's just a law of nature. Worked out well for us in this case. Okay, so in the field of strength B0, absolute value B0, the frequency at which the spin processes is this characteristic frequency, which is this constant gamma times B0, and this is called the Larmor frequency. Okay, so I can write in sort of complex notation what mu of t will be. Mu of t will be e to the I omega 0 t, comma, well, no, let me just, if mu actually starts out in the orthogonal plane, so mu at time 0 is, let's say, 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 0, then mu at time t will be e to the I omega t, and there's a plus or minus, I'm not sure which. And the sad truth is that when you really do these computations, you have to get the pluses and minuses right, because it actually makes a big difference whether it's plus or minus. But I'm not going to worry about it because this is in a mathematics audience. But so it rotates around in a circle like that at this characteristic frequency. All right, now, people who work in magnetic resonance are never satisfied with that formula because that's sort of the stationary state. This is some sense in magnetic resonance, the stationary state. It's processing around with the resonance frequency. So omega naught is sort of the resonance frequency. And we would like to remove that. And the way we do this is, instead of working in the laboratory frame, we work in a frame that rotates around this axis at this frequency. So that in the laboratory frame, in the so-called rotating frame, the vector is actually standing still. So, in a frame rotating with this frequency, with frequency omega 0, the solution becomes, and I'll put here just a little mu tilde to distinguish that I'm in another frame, which is something which I have to say in the MR literature, essentially never done. No one would introduce new notation to actually indicate they were working in a different frame. They just proceed with the same letter. Okay. Now, in a real physical situation, of course, you don't ever have a single proton. In fact, I don't think you ever have a single naked proton. You always have at least a proton bound to a hydrogen in a hydrogen atom, and then the hydrogen atom is usually bound to another hydrogen atom or an oxygen atom. It's very rare to just have protons sitting around. So you have a large collection of protons. Usually bound in water molecules in the kind of applications I have in mind. And we sit this sample in our huge magnetic field, and we leave it there for a long time. And by processes that we're not going to discuss today at all, you get a net magnetization resulting from the proton spin sitting in this field. And we'll call that capital M. And it's a function of X, Y, and Z. And in some sense, it's proportional to the density of the protons at each point in space. And so that's somehow what you want to image, is that density. And initially, we'll call it M0, it's some basically rho x, y, and z times B0. This is our initial state. We have our uniform background field. We have some density of protons. and that produces this net bulk magnetization. Now, to do imaging, the model that I'm going to use is the model which is pretty well ubiquitous, which is that we're going to pretend, for the purposes of this discussion, that one spin at location A and another spin at location B do not interact with one another. And this is true to a reasonable degree of approximation, although, of course, strictly speaking, it's not true. And to do more refined kinds of experiments, you have to somehow model the interaction between different spins. So there are different spins within the same molecule and different spins in different molecules, and they have different interactions, and we're not going to discuss them. But we're going to pretend that they're not interacting at all. And so what happens is we get this equation, the MDT is gamma M cross B, and it's just an ordinary differential equation, and the X, Y, and Z are just parameters. So it's a very simple mathematical model. Now, in a real experiment, thus far, we can't do anything very interesting, because what we have is a magnetic field, and it's parallel to the B0 field, and it's going to stay parallel to the B0 field, because the torque is goes through the cross product. So if it's parallel vectors, the cross product is zero, so nothing will happen. So to do something interesting, we have got to take our vectors, which are pointed up like this, and we have to change their orientation. So what we would like to do is we'd like to flip these guys down, or we'd like to flip some of them down. So we'd like to arrange to get these guys flipped down and maybe leave these guys pointed up. The question is how to do that. So this is the problem of what is called selective excitation. Now, of course, the dynamics is all described by this equation. So it's a question of picking B in such a way that the time evolution is, first of all, different from point to point and satisfies some certain desired final outcome. So what we usually do is rewrite B as a sum of two pieces. So B would be equal to B0, the big background field, plus B1, and sometimes maybe even three pieces, we'll call it a little BG. Well, maybe B1 is sort of two pieces. Now, of course, to do something different at different points in space, we have to have a different B0 field at different points in space. If the B0 field is the same everywhere, then no matter what we do, because the equation doesn't couple different points, every point acts independently of every other point, we're not going to do anything different from point to point. So what we need to do is we need to change B0. So B1 itself is written as a sum of two pieces. So we'll call this one VRF plus B sub G. So B sub G is a gradient field. So what we're going to do, I'm going to talk only about a very special case here, is we're going to change the B0 field so that it is not of constant strength as a function of z, but has a gradient. And in MR, one usually says that the gradient, it's a linear gradient. Well, they really mean a constant gradient. And the dependence of the field is linear in the z-coordinate. So we're going to say b sub g is zg times the vector 0, 0, 1. Now, of course, the immediate response of the mathematician should be, but you can't have a solution to Maxwell's equations with the linear gradient, with a constant gradient. And of course, it does violate Maxwell's equations. Now, how do we get around this? Well, we get around this by making B0 really big. And while it's true that there have to be gradients in other directions as well, they don't really make any appreciable. They don't produce any measurable effect because relative to B0, they're so small. So it's true that really this can't be the whole gradient field. There has to be components in the x and y direction so that the divergence is zero. But they don't make any, they don't really change the evolution of the system over the time period that we're going to be looking in an appreciable way, so we ignore them and pretend that we really can have a field with a constant gradient. All right, good. So, and then we have this RF field. And the RF field is perpendicular to the B0 field. And it has the following general form. So we write BRF as being, right here, as the imaginary part of some function, alpha of t e to the, maybe I'll make, why do I call it the imaginary part? I'll call it the real part. E to the I omega 0 t, or, and the real part, imaginary part, alpha of t, e to the I omega t, and 0. So I think of the RF field as being this resonance sort of field being modulated by this multiplier, alpha of t. So alpha of t is a complex valued function, and it can be, it can change both the magnitude and the phase of the field as a function of time. And again, there's no spatial dependence. I'm pretending that there's only time dependence, and of course, again, that's not really possible, but I can pretend that for the purposes of this discussion. All right, so now let's write out our equation slightly more explicitly, and we're going to forget about the x and y dependence. We'll only have z dependence because nothing in our equation depends on x and y. So x and y will just be parameters. And so what we're doing is we're going to do something that affects the way the magnetization looks along planes given by z equal to constant. All right, so our equation is then in somewhat greater detail. Let's see, what do I want to call this? I'll call that omega 1, I'll call that omega 2. Okay, and what I have done is I have removed this rotating part at the resonance frequency by writing everything in the rotating frame. So really this should be, this should be alpha 1 and alpha 2. So this should be alpha 2, alpha 1. And alpha 1, where alpha is alpha 1 plus I alpha 2. Okay, now, the easiest experiment, so this quantity here, z times g, we just set that equal to f. And we call that the offset frequency. So, What this is that because I don't have a uniform B0 field anymore, because the B0 field has this gradient, the resonance frequency at which the spin will just process freely differs as I move up and down in Z. And this just measures, this F here, this just measures at location Z how much the resonance frequency has changed from my arbitrarily selected omega naught, which is the z equal to zero resonance frequency. So we can forget about even the z dependence, and f is just now a parameter which measures the offset frequency, offset in the resonance frequency. All right, now, so I had this experiment up here, and so the simplest experiment, and now I'm going to take a very simple special case where G is 0, and my simplest experiment is I want to take the spins and I want to flip them over like that. This is called a pi over 2 flip. So I want to flip them by pi over 2. And so what does that mean? It means I want to find alpha of t so that when I solve this equation here, which I'll give this equation a name. Let's call it star. Maybe let's call it 1. When I solve 1 with m of 0 equals 0, 0, 1, then m of tau, some fixed time tau, will be the vector 0, 1, 0. So that's just flipping it down 90 degrees along the y-axis. Okay. Now, you can write down the solution to this equation. Let's suppose we pick a simple choice. Let's take alpha 2 is 0, and alpha 1 will just be a constant. And then the solution, 1, the rotation matrix multiplied by our initial data, and we see that the condition that we require here is that alpha 1 gamma tau should be 4k plus 1 times pi over 2. If alpha 1 satisfies that condition, then at time tau 1, at time tau, our solution will have been flipped down to the y-axis. Okay? And in fact, if k is not 0, then it will have been flipped around 2k times before it gets to the y-axis, or k times before it gets to the y-axis. But those are the solutions. Now, in fact, we don't have to take alpha 1 to be a constant at all. Alpha 1 could be any function of t such that the integral of gamma alpha 1 of t dt from 0 to tau is equal to that number, 4k plus 1 pi over 2. So we see that actually this problem has lots and lots of solutions, and you might ask, well, is one solution better than another solution? And in MR, one of the most important things, because you're actually pumping this RF radiation into a person, one of the most important things is the total energy that you're actually exposing the person to. And in this case, the energy is essentially the integral of alpha 1 of t squared from 0 to tau. And so in this problem, it's easy to say what the best, at least lowest energy pulse would be. The lowest energy pulse is the constant pulse. So I just look at all functions that satisfy that equation, and I try to minimize this function. And it's easy to see that the minimum is obtained for that constant pulse that we wrote down over there. All right, now, this is a very simple problem because I set the gradient equal to 0. Now, the interesting problem arises when the gradient is not equal to 0. So now suppose that g is no longer 0, and then the parameter f reappears in the equation. And I won't rewrite the equation. But let's just say what the problem is. So now we'd like to find a function, alpha of t, so that if m of f and 0 is, let's say, 0, 0, 1, and we solve the equation 1 to time tau, we get mf at time tau. Well, we could say that it should be 0, 1, 0 for f belonging to some band of frequencies, and 0, 0, 1 for f belonging, for f not in that band. Okay? This is the basic selective excitation problem in magnetic resonance imaging. This is what you're trying to do. You're trying to flip the vectors down over a certain band of frequencies, that is, over a certain region in space, and you're trying to leave the rest of them alone. Because in the end, it's the vectors that are flipped down that will process, and the processing of the vectors produces a measurable signal, and you want to know that the measurable signal is coming from a specific place in your sample. And that's how you localize and obtain and actually do imaging with this phenomenon. So this is the basic problem to solve. This is a selective excitation problem. Oh, no, I should call it something else. Why don't I just call it W? It's just the bandwidth where I'm band that I'm exciting the spins. All right, now we have to somewhat reformulate this because you can't actually specify all of these things at once. That is, it's a little bit ambitious to specify tau and everything else at the same time. So what we do, we're going to first of all generalize the problem a little bit, and we're going to make the conditions that we're requiring a little bit less restrictive. And in the end, what you have to see is whether or not the mathematically reformulated problem is adequate for the applications, and it turns out to be adequate for the application. So this is what we're going to do. Instead of requiring an initial condition at zero and an initial condition at tau and a final condition at tau, we're going to require asymptotic conditions. So we're going to say that the limit of m of f and t as t goes to minus infinity should be the vector 0, 0, 1. And the limit of m, well, this requires a little bit of fiddle with. So it's the limit of e to the minus ift, and I write this just as a complex number. The x and y components I combine as a complex number. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to specify the limit as t goes to plus infinity, and it will just be some function, m infinity of the frequency, where m infinity, of course, has to have length 1 for all f, and we'll assume that the limit goes to 0 as f goes to plus and minus infinity. So we get a slightly more general problem. And but we don't specify conditions at times, two finite times. We specify asymptotic conditions at minus infinity time and plus infinity time. Well, this is a classical inverse scattering problem. No. That's not actually what I want. I'm sorry. It's a normalized form of that. Actually, what I want. What I want is that the limit. I'm sorry, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Equals, right. It's very demanding. Okay. Now, so the problem is to find a potential in this 3x3 system of ODEs that will satisfy these two asymptotic conditions. Now, it looks very much like a classical scattering, inverse scattering problem, because here, the parameter f, which goes here and here, acts kind of like an energy or a frequency. Now, it so happens that it is exactly an inverse scattering problem, but to see this, you have to reformulate the equation in a slightly different context. Now, we have to think a little bit abstractly for a minute. This is an equation, really, on SO3. Right, because it's you can think of unit vectors as defining points in SO3, and the cross product is essentially the action of the Lie algebra on SO3. And so this is really an equation on SO3. And we all know that SU2 sits over SO3 as a two-sheeted cover. And so that means an equation on SO3, which is a differential equation, can surely be lifted to an equation on SU2. And so we can reformulate this equation, this 3x3 equation, as a 2x2 complex system. And let me just write it down. I'm certainly not going to derive it. And it becomes this. Where psi is just a two-component vector, valued function, complex valued. Okay, so, and now Q, what is the relationship between Q? So C is just the frequency over 2, and Q is minus I gamma over 2 times alpha 1 minus I alpha 2. Okay, so this has been known for a pretty long time. So the equation, this equation here, this is usually called the Bloch equation. And this is called the spin domain Bloch equation in magnetic resonance imaging. And in inverse scattering theory, it's called the Zaharov-Shabbat 2x2 system. Maybe it's after the Korteweg de Vries equation, the most classically studied equation in inverse scattering theory. All right, so let's reformulate the problem that we want to solve, and the problem we want to solve is the following. Here we want to find Q such that the limit of e to the I xct, t goes to infinity equal to 1 and 0. So here we're going to specify the asymptotic behavior at time is minus infinity. And what we would like is for the asymptotics at time plus infinity to be, psi of x, c, and t should be some function a of x, c, e to the minus I x, c, t, b of x, c, e to the I x, c, t, where a, b of x, c over a of x, c is m1 infinity of f of x, c, not really c over 2. This is 2xc, right? 2xc plus I and 2 infinity of 2xc divided by 1 plus m3 infinity of 2xc. Okay, so this was the data, our original data, for our pulse synthesis problem. It was just this function. Where did it go? Up here. It's that function m infinity of f. F is 2xc, and I just write it like this. Now, m infinity of f is a unit vector valued function, and all this is the stereographic projection of that unit vector valued function. So the two pieces of data are completely equivalent. And what I'm saying is that I want the solution to my equation here, which is normalized like this at time is minus infinity, should be normalized like this as time goes to plus infinity. And people who know scattering theory recognize A and B as the scattering coefficients for this Zaharov-Shabbat system. And the ratio B over A is nothing other than the reflection coefficient. So what we see here is that the problem of selective excitation in MR imaging is reduced to the most classical inverse scattering problem that there is. That is, you specify the reflection coefficient, and what you want is the potential for the Zaharov-Shabbat system that will produce for you that reflection coefficient. Now, I should say this has all been known for a pretty long time. Maybe the first person that I know of who kind of stated these things relatively unambiguously was Alberto Grunbaum, and he studied this formulation. And I think maybe he came to grief because he studied this formulation and did not really fully solve this problem. If he had the spin domain formulation, he probably would have gotten a lot farther. The spin domain formulation was introduced, well, it was introduced in a slightly different context into this pulse synthesis problem, I think, by Jack Lee and Meyer Schnarr. Who did find a way to solve this problem, an approximate solution for this problem, which goes under the name of the SLR method. And around the same time, using actual standard inverse scattering and that formulation, a similar things were obtained by Morris and Wark. And what interested me was, on the one hand, Morris and Rourke's solution should have been the exact solution because they were using the inverse scattering transform. And on the other hand, nobody used Morris and Rourke's solution. The industry standard was the SLR method, which uses an incredibly crude approximation as an intermediate step in designing the pulse. And it mystified me why this should be the case. And it was 15 years since the method was really introduced, or maybe more like 10 years for Morris and Rourke, and nonetheless, nobody used it, and nobody seemed to understand it, and it was almost a pariah in the field. And I was mystified by this and wanted to understand, why was this the case? And I started to read the papers, and I came to the conclusion was that people in the field didn't really understand the inverse scattering transform, and they missed certain very crucial points about the inverse scattering transform. Now, the inverse scattering transform, the inverse problem, has more data. We haven't mentioned all the data yet. And that is because we've only talked about what happens to this equation for real frequencies. It turns out that there's another finite amount of data, finite collection of complex numbers, that are needed to really specify everything about the potential from the point of view of its scattering data. And these are what are called the bound states and Norman constants. So the bound states are just a collection of complex numbers, and the Norman constants are a collection of complex numbers. They go together in pairs, and the imaginary part of Cj will be larger than zero for our discussion, and Cj is never going to be zero. What are these numbers? Well, in addition to requiring that Q have this reflection coefficient, so that is, if I solve this differential equation with that asymptotic condition specified at time equal to minus infinity, at time equal to plus infinity, this is what I find. And this is just something which holds for real frequencies. I want to also find that for frequencies equal to C sub j, this equation has an L2 solution, or what would be called in physics a bound state. And then the C sub j is a kind of a subtle constant that I don't want to try to explain, which is additional data which is needed to get a completely determined system, and whose role actually remains rather mysterious, I think, in both mathematics and physics. All right, now, so then that brings us to the question. How do we pick this data to get a good answer? Right? The problem, so when you first start thinking about pulse synthesis, well, it looks like a very hard problem because I specify this M infinity and I'm looking for a potential, and does such a thing exist, and how do I find it? And it actually turns out that, in a sense, there are far too many solutions. And the real problem is not whether there is a solution. The real problem is, how do you pick a good solution? And this is where the next little tidbit of information comes from. It so happens that for many, many years now, in the inverse scattering literature, there's been a formula relating the power in Q, the square integral of Q, to the scattering data. And this is this formula goes back to Zakharov and Fadeyev for the KdV equation, and Zakharov and Manikov for this equation, And this is the formula. It says the integral of q squared from minus infinity to plus infinity is 1 over pi times the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity times the log of 1 plus the absolute value of r of x squared dx plus 4 times the sum of the imaginary parts of x sub j as j goes from 1 to n. Okay. So that formula tells us the answer to our question. It says, if we want to find the RF, the CJs do not appear. That's right. That's why they remain mysterious. Because they don't appear in any formulas. And the reason somehow is these are conserved quantities under the flows. This is sort of the more traditional view of inverse scattering. These are conserved quantities. The CJs evolve. So somehow you don't really know what they mean because they evolve. But these have a definite meaning because they're conserved. So what we see here is that, so the corollary is, in order to get the desired M infinity, we must use the RF envelope with the given reflection coefficient and no bound states. Right? Because remember, the Xi j all lie in the upper half plane. So the imaginary part of Xi j is always positive. So any bound states that you include are going to increase the energy consumption necessary in the pulse without any additional, without doing anything towards the magnetization profile that you're trying to find. Yeah. Well, I'm saying for some purposes it is the best possible. It's a good place to start in all cases. Okay, so actually it tells us a couple things. It tells us, first of all, what the lowest possible energy is, which is of some interest. Because you could say, well, I would like to do the following experiment. And you describe the magnetization profile it takes to do that experiment. And then you just plug it into this formula and you say, oops, we can't do this experiment because it's going to require too much power to be deposited inside the person. So we can't do this. We have to modify the experiment somehow. So that's one thing you can use this formula for right off the bat. Another thing you use the formula for is that it tells you which pulse is the minimum energy pulse. So then you design that pulse, you find that pulse, and then you go from there. There are other properties that the pulses, there are other good and bad properties that pulses can have. So maybe I should, I don't have a lot of time left, so. So, what are the basic things that you have to play off against one another? Well, the first thing is the energy. The second thing is the pulse duration. The third thing is the oscillation and amplitude. And the fourth thing is the need for rephasing. All right, so let me just say one more, draw one other conclusion from this formula, and then I'll talk about these things. Another thing that is extremely important in magnetic resonance is what's called an inversion pulse. And that's where you take the vector 0, 0, 1, and you turn it into the vector 0, 0, minus 1. Now, it's not hard to see. You just look at this formula here. Frequencies at which that happens correspond to frequencies where the reflection coefficient is infinite, right? Because the denominator is zero and the numerator is zero. Well, they're both zero. You work it out and you see that actually it blows up. It's the stereographic image of the pole. So that's what happens when if you're getting closer and closer to the pole. What happens is R goes to infinity. Now, what this formula tells you is that it is not possible to invert the spins for a range of frequencies of positive length with a finite energy pulse, because this is infinite. If R of C is infinite over an interval of finite positive length, this is infinite. And this is something that people would like to do, But the formula says you cannot do it. So you do the best you can. You just try to get the spin as close. You try to specify a little cone, and you try to make 1 plus r. 1 minus r is the KdV. 1 plus r. Yeah. It's positive. Better be. Yeah, here R is anything. Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't have the same significance as it does in the KdV. Because, again, this has to do with it not being a self-adjoint problem. So that's another, I think, important consequence of this formula. You cannot invert frequencies lying in a band of positive length. So you do what you can. You know, you try to get the mole to sit into a cone of a certain size. And given the size of the cone and the width of the band, you can estimate the minimum amount of energy required to do that. All right, so that's another nice little property of that formula. So we've talked about the energy. Now, the pulse duration. So I'm not going to describe the method for finding the pulse. So this is sort of classically known, that there's a system of equations called the Gelfand-Levitin-Marchenko equations. And it's a system of integral equations. And you get one integral equation for each time t, and you solve that equation, and you evaluate the solution that you got at time t. And that gives you q of t, or half q of t, something like this. And there's a theorem. It's a system of Fredholm equations. There's a theorem with the adjoint has a trivial null space. The equation itself has a trivial null space. So you know that the equation has a unique solution for every value of t under fairly weak hypotheses, basically on R. Now, of course, the problem is it doesn't tell you the existence theorem for Fredholm equations doesn't tell you how to solve the equation. And you need to do some work to actually solve the equation. And one of the things I found was an algorithm that actually allows you to solve the equation for all times in a relatively stable way. So what happens is you use this Marchenko equation, and it gives you an answer. And the answer typically looks something like this. Now, there's a Paley-Wiener theorem. There's a Paley-Wiener theorem for between R and Q. And the Paley-Wiener says, basically, if R is compactly supported, then Q cannot be. Okay? And R is, generally speaking, compactly supported. So Q cannot be. That means that Q actually has support all the way out to time equal to infinity. Well, that's not too useful in a real MR experiment. A real MR experiment, you have to do things pretty quick. As I was saying, you really need to do things quick because the model that we're using is not an absolutely correct physical model. We've left out some relaxation terms. And if you don't do the thing quick enough, the differential equation no longer describes the system. So you have a very definite time limit, which actually depends upon what you're imaging, but there's a definite time limit for how long this pulse can last. So what you have to do, of course, is you have to cut it off. You have to start at some place and stop at some place. And you don't have that much control. Well, R determines the duration. So again, this is going to be something that will go into whether or not the experiment is feasible. You design the pulse, and you see what you get out from the inverse transform from the potential. So you specify the magnetization profile, or the R, and you see what the inverse scattering transform produces for you as a potential. And either it lasts too long or it doesn't. If it lasts too long, then it is possible to actually shorten the duration of the pulse by adding in bound states. So there's a trade-off between bound states and pulse duration. You'll increase the amplitude and you'll increase the power, but you can shorten the duration. Now, the last thing here is what's called the need for rephasing. Well, that comes from the following observation. I didn't really write the formula down. You don't really go out to time equal to infinity. You actually go to some finite time. And then what happens is you don't get exactly what you were hoping for in the magnetization profile. You get what you were hoping for multiplied by a phase that depends linearly on the frequency. And what's done in actual MR experiments is that you reverse the gradient field and you let the system freely process, that is just continue to process for a certain amount of time, and it unwinds that phase. So it unwinds that term that comes from taking the conjugate of that divided by that. Actually, the conjugate of that times that. Okay? So you have to unwind the phase. That's what's called rephasing. And once again, this is something that the inverse scattering transform simply produces for you. The amount of rephasing that's required is essentially the T1. So if you say your pulse is going to go from T0 to T1, if T1 is positive, if T1 isn't zero, you need to do rephasing. If T1 is negative, then the rephasing is just, you just allow the system to precess freely for T1 units of, absolute value T1 units of time. If T1 is positive, you have to reverse the polarity of the gradient and allow it to precess for that many units of time, and then you get what you were looking for. Now again, this can be a problem, because time is sort of a critical parameter in these kinds of experiments. You might not want to spend the time rephasing. And again, what you can do is you can trade off energy for rephasing time. So you can, by putting poles into the upper half plane, you can push, you can change the shape of the pulse so that it lasts a shorter, the T1 is closer to zero. So you get another pulse that does the same thing, but it ends sooner. Okay, in fact, in the paper of Rourke and Morris, what they show, what they do is they take, instead of using R, they use a rational function which approximates R, and they use that in the inverse scattering transform, and they get a pulse which actually is supported in the negative half ray, ending at time zero, so it doesn't need to be rephased at all. Now, these pulses, I think, again, you wonder, why didn't anybody use these pulses? Well, these pulses have tremendously more energy than is required, and they're tremendously more oscillatory. So there has to be a trade-off between rephasing and power, which they didn't really capture in their work. And we can see it more clearly here. Okay, so that's what I wanted to